If you're running a retail business, don't let disorganized order fulfillment cause chaos. Use ShipStation instead. From running a business out of your garage to multiple warehouses, ShipStation is ideal for every phase of your growth. Save time with one login for all your stores and by automating tasks, plus you'll get the best shipping rates from global carriers. Calm the chaos with the shipping software that delivers. Start a free trial at ShipStation.com/audio. That's ShipStation.com/audio.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
A member of the DATC media family.
Previously on the Tragically Hip Top 40 Countdown.
What did you think of We Want to Be It when you heard it for the first time?
Oh, I loved it. I love this song. There's from the first listen, I remember listening to this album for the first time and first of all, loving the sound of all of it. I remember being surprised also that that a lot of, you know, countdowns or top albums online, blogs or whatnot, would put this one kind of low on the list, because this album kind of resonated with me a lot, the soundscape.
Hey, it's JD here, and welcome to the Tragically Hip Top 40 Countdown. It is an absolute pleasure to be with you week over week, where we're counting down 40 essential tracks by the hip that you selected with your very own top 20 ballots. I then tabulated the results using an abacus and a kazoo orchestra, led by a sentient ham sandwich who insists on being called Maestro Dijon. How will your favorite song fare in the rankings? You'll need to tune in every week to find out. So there's that. This week I'm joined by Tragically Hip superfan, Darren from Toronto. Darren from Toronto, how the hell are you doing on this hip-tastic day?
I'm doing great, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm actually in the midst of a really good stretch here. So despite the rain and the gray sky today, I'm feeling all right.
Excellent.
What do you say we get right into things here and start talking about Darren from Toronto's origin story or his hipstery, as it were?
Sure, no problem. Is there anything in particular you want me to go into or just sort of start where I...
Let's start at the start. Let's start at the start and we'll, you know, we'll wander on through the trail. Yeah.
Right. Well, my history goes back to probably originally hearing songs like Small Town Bring Down and Last American Exit on probably Q107 back in...
Right.
80, whatever, 9, 87, around that
yeah,
era.
Yeah.
And then when Up to Here was released, it was funny, my dad bought the cassette. I'm 56 right now. My dad is in his 80s, but at that time, he bought the cassette for Up to Here, having heard songs and liked what he had heard.
And, cool, dad.
Yeah, I know, exactly. So he used to sing the song She Didn't Know. And every time it came on the radio, he would sing, "She didn't know about all the money." And I was like, that's not even the lyrics to the song. And he's like, I don't care. So I actually, the first album I had was his cassette of Up to Here. When it had originally come out. So the first album I think I bought myself was Road Apples. And I started seeing the band in 1991. The first show I saw was at the Concert Hall in July of 91. And then shortly after they played Ontario Place in Toronto, the Ontario Place Forum
yeah.
in August. So I saw two shows sort of back like within a month in 91. And they were probably, I guess it was probably Road Apples that it was in 91. They were kind of road testing stuff like 100th Meridian at the time. I think it was, was that called Ouch, I think, before? Or it was something else that.
I do not know.
I think it had.
It's not Ouch for sure, because Ouch was on Saskadelphia, right?
Oh, that's right. Yeah. It wasn't fully formed as 100th Meridian. There was a lot of like repeating of the line, "I remember Buffalo" in it. I remembered it. I distinctly remember it at the concert hall. So those were like the first couple of shows that I saw by them, and ended up seeing them about 34 or 35 times between 91 and 2016. Saw a lot of shows, mostly in Toronto, a lot of like Maple Leaf Gardens and, Molson Park and, the ACC kind of stuff, typical Toronto kind of big stadium stuff. But I saw a few interesting runs. I saw 3 days in a row on the Hen House tour out west in Spokane, Washington, Portland, Oregon, and Seattle. So that was cool. Like
what era theaters. Was that? Trouble at
the Hen House. Okay. So it was like 95. 95 or 6.
Yeah.
And then I saw another run in 98 on the east coast of the US for Phantom Power, and it was Northampton, Massachusetts, where they had recorded the Something On video.
Oh, okay.
Before we went in to see the show. There was Northampton, there was Portland, Maine.
Hampton. Portlands.
Yeah, I saw in both Portlands. And I think it was a state theater in both of them or something. I can't remember. But Hampton Beach Casino, which I'll tell you a little story about in a minute.
Yeah, I was going to follow up on that anyway.
So Hampton Beach Casino, there was a show in what's it called? Martha's Vineyard.
Okay.
And it ended with a show at Sugarbush in Vermont. So it was five shows over like probably 6 days or something like that.
Oh, I'm so envious of that. I never did. I did two nights. I did Hamilton and Toronto back to back, but I never did anything more grand than that.
Yeah.
So I'm really proud of what you did. That's
cool. It was really cool. Like seeing them in small places, like the Martha's Vineyard show in particular, there was a, supposed to be a hurricane. It ended up being a tropical storm. So there was like almost nobody at the show. It almost got canceled, but, ended up going to see them at that. There was like maybe 100 people at that show.
Oh my God.
So standing at the stage with, you know, people, and half of them were like, don't even know who the band is kind of thing. Jeez. It was
the pretty dumb awesome. Half.
Yeah. All right. So it was a great set. The last show was the Sugarbush show, and it was infamously one where a lot of people didn't get to see the show because the buses were all delayed coming over across the mountain. It was on a ski hill in Sugarbush. But we had driven, so I actually ended up at the show, saw the whole thing, but most of the people arrived during the encore. The Hampton Beach Casino show was pretty cool because we kind of like interacted with them over the course of a few days, sort of following them around, you know, met the band. And this will go on for a little. I have a couple of stories that kind of, that kind of like that pivot off of it. But the Hampton Beach show was cool because it was the show where I had just mentioned on one of the forums that during the show, there was two things. A friend of mine was with me, and at that show, Gord used to have a banana shaker he would shake, and it had broken, and the pellets were falling out of it. So he gave her, at the end of the show, the banana, and the whole band signed it. So she has like a signed banana from the whole band that he used to use on stage.
Holy shit.
Yeah. And then the other thing that happened was that show was that he, for a while in the Phantom Power tour, his acoustic guitar that he used to play had a big piece of like duct tape on the top edge of it, like just black tape on the corner. And at that show, I distinctly remember this happening, and he had tripped going off stage and ended up, when they came back on, he came back on with his guitar and it had duct tape on it, because I guess he had tripped and kind of broken it or something. Oh, and it was on there for like years after this show. Like they hadn't gotten it fixed, but it had this duct tape on the corner of it. So anyhow, cool shows. It was great to meet the band and interact with them. And the funny thing was this was in 98, and then around 2000, 2001, I was at a Rheostatics show. Cause we'll get to the websites, but one of the websites I do is a Rheostatics live website. And so I was at a show at Ted's Wrecking Yard in Toronto.
Remember Ted's Wrecking
Yard. And Gord used to go to hip shows he went to all the hip shows, but he would go to Rheostatics shows. And this one night I'm standing there in the crowd on the stage, and I turn and he's standing beside me. And I'm like, holy shit. Right.
Yeah.
And I had met him a couple of years before. And he turned to look at me and he said, "Hey, Darren."
No, he did not.
I was like, "How the fuck do you remember my name?" And I thought it was like such a crazy thing. And then I found out years later that's one of the things, he just remembered people's names and faces and could pull up people's names years later. And he did that. And I was like, holy shit. But what was interesting was we were seeing this show, and the Rheostatics have this song called Four Little Songs, which is like four songs put together into like one song. And we were talking about it because they were playing it, and he just turned and he's like, "You know, I'm just so amazed that a band can write a song like this. Like, it's just so creative and interesting." And then like 10 years later, however long, they ended up with the Depression Suite,
which ended up
being these three songs and very similar. And I was like, I always wondered if it was like, if there was an inspiration to kind of like drawn from that kind of song. Yeah. I have no idea, but,
if anybody out there does know, send us an email, tthtop40@gmail.com.
That's right. I mean, it could have just been Bob Rock who threw them together for all we know.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I read this in the book, or maybe it was in the doc, but I'm pretty sure it was that Paul picked the three songs that were going to go together.
Did he?
Yeah. When they sort of had the idea to do, you know, a suite. So I'm not sure whether I've just dreamt this or whether that's factually correct, but I digress. Back to you.
Yeah, no problem. But anyhow, interesting little stories. I'm sure you get them from everybody you talk to. I do have one infamous show that I was at. Well, infamous in that,
I'm intrigued.
It was the only show that they ever performed the song Emergency from Day for Night.
Get out of here.
Played it one time, and it was before Day for Night was released. And it was at a industry benefit show for the family of, a gentleman named Brian Eagle, who was part of the MCA Records Canada group. And he ended up dying at 38 years old of all age. And this is like in May of 1993, I think he died.
Okay.
And they ended up doing a benefit show for him, his family, at the Phoenix in December of that year. And The Hip and The Pursuit of Happiness were the two bands that played.
Nice.
And at that show, that was the only show they ever performed Emergency live.
Wow. So you're one of, let's paint the picture of the Phoenix. It's maybe 1,000 people? Maybe?
Maybe.
Yeah. 750 even?
And probably a lot of like, not necessarily hip fans, but sure. Just, you know, friends.
TPOH fans and people who are there for the benefit. Yeah.
But
wild.
Interestingly, it's funny. I remembered this for years. Like, I distinctly remember hearing them play it. And I thought maybe I had made it up, like that it was in my mind for, like, you know, 20 years. And then somebody, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, posted the set list, like the handwritten set list with the song on it. And I was like, oh, okay, it wasn't in my mind. And they also played
so great.
And they played another song called Win as well, which I think they only played a few times also.
I've never heard it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's no recording of that show. So, yeah, interesting.
Rats.
Kind of little tidbit, kind of thing. But it was nice. Those US shows were great because it was, you know, being Canadian and being living in Toronto, a lot of the shows that they would do in Toronto were always very kind of greatest hits-ish kind of shows, crowd-pleasing stuff. And then you would see them go on tour and see all the songs that they were throwing in the States. And it was like, oh man, I really want to hear these deep cuts. And those US tour dates that I saw were really, really like that, where they would play sort of stuff that you weren't necessarily expecting. And it was older albums, so there wasn't as much material to draw from.
Sure, sure. You know, it's just, it's a shame they stopped touring when they did, and definitely why they stopped touring. But it's sad to me that some albums, like Now for Plan A and Man, Machine, Poem, don't get the longevity and the life that they so richly deserve, you know, by being played numerous times in a set.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, for a long time, man, Now for Plan A, there was a period where it was absolutely my favorite hip album. And it was one of the only two, I think, albums that I didn't see them on tour with.
No.
It was that one, and there was one other one.
What kind of tour did they do for Now for Plan A? I know that was the one where they did the pop-up in Kensington.
Right, yeah, they did those Kensington Market shows.
Very cool.
4 or 5 songs or something small that they...
Yeah, oh yeah, but they were doing it in like a, you know, like out the window of a restaurant, basically.
Yeah,
or a
right,
shop.
Exactly.
Yeah, find that video online if you can, people. It's pretty fun.
I think Plan A and In Between Evolution were the only two albums I didn't see them at some point do a show from. And In Between Evolution, I was between my first and second daughter who were born. So I wasn't really seeing much
yeah, I guess,
at that point.
I guess not.
And 2012, it's funny for Plan A, I don't remember why. And I haven't gotten to that point in the archive yet. So I'm not sure. I can't remember how much they toured it. Anyhow, those are the two. But yeah, to your point, you know, those last few albums, there really wasn't a lot of public airing of the material. Even on the last tour, I think they only did one night where they played any songs from We Are the Same.
Oh, okay.
I think it was somewhere out west. They did one night, maybe somewhere in Alberta, I think, maybe Edmonton. All the other albums were featured multiple nights over it, but that one album was not, was only done the one time. Which is interesting considering, you know, if you watch the documentary, their reflection on it isn't particularly positive either. Their own self-reflection on the album, it didn't seem like it was as positive an experience for a variety of reasons.
Oh, yeah. That part of it is just so shocking.
Yeah.
So shocking. Did you enjoy the documentary?
I loved it. I thought they did a fantastic job. I think it gave some nice insight into areas that people probably didn't have visibility into.
Yeah.
It was obviously very emotional and upsetting in some ways. But I liked that it was honest. I'm sure there's lots of honesty that was probably left out of it, like everything, but they really kind of got a lot in there that really, I think, got to the essence of the good and the bad of the band and how things, you know, progressed with them. And you could see the emotion and even sort of the honesty of Rob talking about sort of drinking and some other stuff that was going on. And it was a it was a fairly, you know, some warts and all kind of documentary. And I think it over the four episodes really was a great capture of their arc of their career. So yeah, I loved it. I thought it was really well done. I could watch another 10 episodes.
Yeah, I wish each record got an episode, you know, even if it's only a 30 minute episode, just each record gets, you know, that sort of time. But clearly, like you said, some of those later records, they didn't, you know, even despite the experiences in the studio with like Hugh Padgham and stuff like that, they don't necessarily, you know, make them make their eyes twinkle, you know?
Yeah.
Which is sort of disappointing because I love some of those later records now. Love them.
Yeah. I think the records are far better than they think they are. If I had to sort of be my takeaway from it.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you sort of listen to all of it, there really isn't the only album that I would say that there was potentially a dip that I could, in my own preference of records, would be We Are the Same, which has great songs, but it doesn't sit as cohesively. It does feel a little bit more like maybe there was some Gord stuff in there that became hip stuff. Some of the more sort of the more mellow-ish kind of things. And I love the slow hip stuff. I mean, I'm a huge fan of all of it. It just had a different feel to it.
It does. Yeah, there's no doubt about it.
And I love how, like, you know, when in listening to like the album Man Machine Poem, how it really kind of was, it's such a different album in its style. And I think a lot probably was influenced by Kevin Drew, who I love. I'm a huge Broken Social Scene fan. And I love his work. And I think that he brought a little bit of different kind of fairy dust to it. And so I think that, you know, Kevin Drew added a bit of his own sort of fairy dust to the sort of style of and sound of that record. And it would have been really interesting to see where they potentially would have gone, kind of getting into a bit more of an experimental area for them.
Agreed.
Yeah. Agreed. Like,
we can only imagine.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I like, cause there's a lot of really like Man and Machine, both of those songs, and Great Soul and Hot Mic. Like, it just had a different sound. It sounded like they were writing from a different, I don't know, different place than maybe they had historically, or at least there was a sound that was different. So
it's a very,
I love that album.
It's a very concise record as well, right? 10 tracks, you know, it's a quick hit. It's, I think, 38 minutes long. And it just goes in your veins so nice.
And it's got a really good, concise style to it. And it's unique in that there's none of it sound, I can't, none of the songs sound like other hip songs to me, for the most part. They have a different kind of feel to them. I don't know.
I would agree with that. I'm trying to think right now.
You know, whereas up to that album, everything, there was a lot of things that they did had variations on a theme. But you think about things like Streets Ahead, and that like sounds like a hip song from, you know, Now for Plan A. Like, they have a hip quality to them.
Yeah, agreed.
Anyhow, I don't know. I don't know what it was about that record. Maybe it was Kevin's influence. Maybe it was them. But there was something interesting about it that was different and heading off in a different direction. So
for sure,
it'll be interesting to see if when they get to those later albums, what kind of unreleased studio stuff they have that will come out, if there's any.
I really hope they do the reissue for every record. That's my dream. My gut tells me, just based on a random conversation I had with Johnny on the last year's podcast, Discovering Downey. And I made mention right at the end of the interview, I said, oh, I can't wait for your reissue of Music at Work. I love that record. And Johnny was like, ugh, we don't. And then he said, but I will tell you something. I've been listening the hell out of Inviolet Light. And I think that's a really underrated record. Now, was he listening to it because he's going through the archival process? I don't know. But that was my gut, that's going to be the next one we see. Or maybe they're a record ahead, even, you know, that might be the next one that we see after Up to Here. Who knows?
Yeah.
Darren, we can talk about hip all day.
I know. but to the point about Music at Work, it's funny because that album for a lot of years was my favorite hip album. And then, I think because it's so different and not, it's all like deep cuts, you know, things like The Completists and Train Overnight and like that kind of stuff, which, you know, Wild Mountain Honey, or which I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The stuff that you go to shows hoping that they'll play and they never do.
But you will get Music at Work.
That's right. Exactly.
Or It's My Music at Work. Darren, what do you say we spin the record the other way and talk about the song of the week?
Sure. Absolutely. Let's go for it.
All right. We'll be right back after this.
Hey, this is Paul Langlois from the Tragically Hip saying hello. Now on with the countdown.
39. I can remember Greg pointing me in the direction of You're Not the Ocean when I was initially doing research for my first podcast based on the hip, Fully and Completely. I loved it, and it stuck. Darren from Toronto, what did you think of You're Not the Ocean when you heard this kickoff track the first time?
I loved the whole album from the beginning, the Whole World Container album. It was definitely more polished, but I love the track. You're Not the Ocean was another in a long line of amazing opening songs for hip albums.
Agreed. Agreed. It's uncanny, their ability.
It is. They had a great ability to begin and end albums with great, great songs. So it's sometimes hard to, it's like trying to pick a favorite opening track from an album. It's like, there's probably seven of the, however many albums they had, 14 or eight, I can't remember. Yeah. That I could pick as like my favorite openers, but it is right up there. It is a really great song, and it starts, it kind of sets this tone for the album that I think is, it's interesting because I listened to your and Greg's podcast about this recently as well, the World Container album.
Oh, okay.
To refresh sort of that perspective on it. And it was interesting hearing you guys talk about it. And it, you know, it's an interesting album because the song itself is sort of an encapsulation of the style. Like there's an aggression to it and an anxiety, but it's all, for the most part, it's a very upbeat sounding record. But there's an intensity to it, like something going on this during the creation of the album. There's a lot of deep lyrics and a lot of like, if I read into it, there's a lot of like interpersonal things going on, family or friends or something in there that sort of drove a lot of the lyrics that like many hip songs, you know, you can read them at face value or you can read them as an interpretation. And sometimes there's three versions of what the song might be about.
Oh my gosh. You're totally right.
And this is one of those songs. It's like that. It's short, like everything on the album. Like I think it's 3.5 minutes or something along those lines.
Yeah.
But a great opening song, to what I think is definitely one of their strongest albums.
Interesting take. I haven't heard, I don't disagree with you necessarily. It would be in my middle third.
Of your favorite albums.
Yeah. Like I can't rank them, but I have thirds sort of, you know, and it's in my middle third.
I mean, I'd say it's in my top, but it probably would end up in my middle if I actually had to do the math on all of it.
So. Yeah. It's tough, man. I don't know how you guys all picked your top 20. For me, it took me like a day and there was like whittling down. I basically wrote like as many songs as I loved. And then I started to like, okay, who gets to go, who gets to stay?
I think impossibilium is the word to how you actually are able to try to come up with your top songs.
So talk to me a little bit more about You're Not the Ocean. Did you get to see it live?
I did. Yeah. Actually, I missed the first time they ever played it live was, I was looking cause I've been doing this archive and, it was at the second Fort York show in June of 2006. I went to the first night, so I didn't see them debut that. But I did see it on other tours. So yeah, I always thought it was a really great opener. It's funny, you know, I sing in a band and I've sang, I love music, I sing along, I make up words. I pay attention to lyrics half the time. I'm a big fan of like how music sounds, like how the words sound, what's the cadence of the vocal, like an instrument. So often I don't even necessarily know what the song is about. I may not even be singing it right. But I like how the words sound to me phonetically.
Yes.
So with the hip songs, I always find that whenever I actually have to dig in and try to think about what does this song mean, I usually have no idea. And I have to kind of like really think about what are the words saying. And every time I do, it's like trying to tear apart an onion. Like there's just layers to it. And it's really hard to understand the poetry of where it's coming from, but there's also like universal themes to it. So you get the essence of the vibe of it and what you think it's about. And then the reality is probably something else entirely to Gord, to the writer. So it's the same with like a band like Yes, like John Anderson stuff. Like, I don't know what the hell he's talking about, but I love how it sounds. So, when I sort of was reading through the lyrics to it, I was like, oh, okay, I kind of get the gist of this, the metaphor of the song. You know, it's at face value, it's, he could be literally standing on the beach and talking about a lake and an ocean, and actually talking about maybe there's a water theme and his whole involvement with pure water and clean water, and maybe there's a piece of that. The song itself is as I would interpret it, is really a metaphor for like how people try to, it's like about an antagonistic relationship or something in a relationship where you are trying to hold off somebody else in some way. You're trying to stave off their impact on you.
Okay.
That's sort of my take on it. And it's funny, when I was listening to some of the live tracks, every time he introduced the song, he would say, this is called "You're Not the Ocean," and it's a compliment. I don't, you know, it's not an insult. It's a compliment. You're not the ocean. And that was kind of his sort of,
wow.
How he would introduce it at many shows. He said, it's a song of defiance and willful denseness. And what else do you need to get through the day? That was in Toronto in 2009. But he would often refer to it sort of being as a song that was that it was supposed to be a compliment, saying you're not the ocean, because I think the ocean is the bad guy, essentially the bad person in this, the person that's trying to creep up. And if you listen to the lyrics, how it develops, you know, initially it's, you know, you're up to my toes, and then it's you're not even close, and then I'm standing on my toes, which is like what somebody does when you're trying to sort of stand up above the water. Like if you're on your toes, cause it's like the water's rising.
There's a level of anxiety there that comes with that.
And then it gets to, you know, you're up to my chin, you're not coming in. And when he gets to those lines, he changes how he sings it. Also, it gets to, there's that desperate sound to how he's singing that stress. So it's, you know, it's this sort of, this, you know, drowning, this potential drowning scene, you know, metaphor of like the water rising, and it's like you're trying to like do whatever you can to, you're not getting in, you know, about whatever this situation is with another person, assuming that that's what it's about. But that's kind of how I interpreted the song. It's probably obvious. I'm really shitty with metaphors and stuff.
You put yourself out there. That's more than a lot of people will do, you know? So I appreciate that. Thanks.
It has some interesting lines as well, just about, you know, Brittany Invisible and the stranger and myself. And I think you guys talked about it on your old podcast as well. But it was it's funny because when I looked at it, I'm like, as I look through lyrics and read lyrics through the lyrics, like there's an immense amount of quotes that he uses in his lyrics to songs, and references to things that you think you understand what it is, but then, you know, it's like in, what's the one where he talks about, Canada Lee, is that Direwolf, I think?
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, until I looked at the lyrics, I'm like, I thought Canada Lee was some kind of reference to Canada. And then I realized it was a person, and there's this whole story that these characters are sort of drawn into the metaphor. Anyhow, a couple of interesting lines in this song as well that, you know, you can look up to try to understand the context, but they're maritime reference. Well, one's a maritime reference, and the other one is, relates to a German soldier in World War II, I think, in his memoirs. So they're anxiety related references, you know, sort of what's happening around you and trying to have some control over the environment you're in for things that you may not necessarily be able to control. And I think that's what he was probably getting at with those references. So
I like it.
Yeah. I have one other thing I was going to say about this song, because it's funny. I was, you know how Gord, you know, will use lyrics in, he'll use the same lines in multiple songs.
And yes. Yes.
On many records. And in this song, he refers to take and take and take. And I didn't realize until later that in fact, he uses that same line in If New Orleans Is Beat from In Between Evolution, where he's talking about the river takes and takes and the river takes and takes and takes. And then in this song, he talks about the lake takes and takes and takes. So it's this different album. But same line reference.
The man loved his water themes. Certain.
But I love how he used those. He would use the same lines in multiple songs. I always thought that was really.
Oh, I love really, that too. Because to me, it was like, is he underscoring this? Is this more important? You know, like a super farmer. What's the super farmer? Garbage bag trees, you know, like these lines that just repeat themselves in your.
Garbage bag trees, you know, garbage bag. It's funny. I remember hearing about that. I was like, oh, garbage bag trees. That's like where you walk around in the winter and there's plastic bags stuck in trees everywhere. Right.
Yeah.
But who would throw that into a song? Right.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Well, Darren, it's been an absolute pleasure hearing your hipstery and breaking down this song with you, but I'm wondering if you have anything you'd like to plug.
Yeah. I mean, I probably came to your attention a bit because of this new archive that I've been doing.
Yeah.
The new hip archive, which is basically identical and looks to many other sites that I do. This is just a fan of music kind of thing. I just do it because I have either material or pack rat stuff, but I started years ago, probably back in the early mid 2000s. Doing some archive stuff. It was actually a band called Wheat that were from the United States, from Massachusetts. Okay. And at the time everybody had like FTP archive sites. You could get a login, you can go in and pull down MP3s of shows and that. And it was kind of like the first digital trading kind of process after people were trading, you know, cassettes.
Right.
And then they started to kind of get shut down. So with this one group, I had asked them about it and they ended up saying, it's cool. Go ahead. You can set up a site. And I did that with them. And then I did something with the Spoons. And then I did something with a huge site with the Rheostatics live archive where, you know, people would send me shows. The band would give me cassettes and videos and all sorts of stuff. And it kind of like just evolved. I set one up for the Bourbon Tabernacle Choir and Thomas Trio and the Red Albino. So there's like a bunch of like sort of mostly Canadian bands that I use the same format. And really the idea was just to be able to provide some live music content that used to be available on these FTP sites, but had disappeared at that point, and wanting to have it available somewhere and always with the blessing of the bands that I kind of have done it with.
Oh, so, that's great. That's great to hear.
So this one was, you know, recently watching the documentary, I was like, you know, there used to be a hip bass archive that was up and it disappeared. And I think it might just be on torrents right now. Some people have stuff that if they send you a link, you can kind of get things, but there isn't like a site. And I thought there probably, hopefully, should be something that's just got everything potentially available. Pull it all into one place, make it easy to just download an MP3 or a FLAC file and give some basic information, this you know, a link to the set list, you know, the information text file, just so that people who are collecting can kind of get an idea. And I've been putting like a rating of what I think the sort of overall quality is.
Oh, okay.
That kind of thing. So it's really just like by year, this archive that I'm working on, I'm almost through it. I'm at 2009. I just put up today the We Are the Same tour. There's still a bunch more to go. And then I have some people that have reached out that have more content that may or may not be out there that they're going to send me.
Exciting.
So yeah, hopefully it will like pull in as much stuff that's out there and be like a one spot stop shop for like, not shop because there's no, you don't have to pay anything for it. it's all free and sort of stuff that's been out there. So just a one place to kind of go to and hopefully have a majority of what used to be available around. And that was kind of the intention of it. You know, people who collect live music love that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
So yeah, it's been amazing sort of putting it together. There's a lot of stuff. I think I put up 40 plus shows today from 2009. I mean, there's probably over 300 or 350 shows up there already.
That's extraordinary. Wow.
Yeah. So it's been, it's a lot of time to do it.
I bet.
I figured out a way to kind of do it quickly, relatively quickly. I think it's
high speed dubbing, right?
Well, it's more about process and trying to, how do I do the same thing over and over again, sure, as fast as possible? So it's kind of like coming up with a way to kind of put things together.
Right.
And I've kind of got my style on how I do that. And then, so it's coming together nicely. And
can you give us the URL?
Yes, it's www.thehiparchive, thehiparchive.com.
I love it. You even gave it the nice cadence there, so it rhymed.
I didn't even know it had it until then. And then there's a link, you know, you can send on, you know, there's a, you know, got content, you know, link. And I've got an email, I think it's info@thehiparchive.com, which comes to me. And if you have anything you want to provide or have suggestions where to look, people can send me emails there as well. Excellent. And I've been posting on Facebook and things like that as well as I've been doing each year.
Keep flying the flag, Darren from Toronto. Keep flying the fucking flag. I love it.
Can I say thank you for all of these hip shows that you do? Because it's really awesome and it's really nice having all this out there.
Oh, thanks, so, man.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Much appreciated.
That's what we've got for you this week. I want to thank Darren from Toronto for stopping by and sharing. I want to thank you for listening. Pick up your shit.
Thanks for listening to the Tragically Hip Top 40 Countdown. To email us, send an email to tthtop40@gmail.com. We're social. Find us on all the socials at tthtop40.
Duvra. Podcasts and such.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.